Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JP Morgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by comedian, actor, writer, and director, Rami Youssef. I first sat down with Rami last spring, where he was campaigning around season 3 of his self-titled show, Rami, available on Hulu. Since then, you may have seen him in Poor Things alongside Emma Stone and Willem Dafoe, or perhaps his work in The Bear, where he directed that great episode in season 2, where Marcus, played by Lionel Boyce, is learning how to make pastries in Copenhagen while living on a boat, which is either the best month of someone's life or the absolute worst. And if you watch that episode, it's somehow both, and it's a testament to Rami's talent as a filmmaker that the team at The Bear actually brought him in, which is pretty rare for them, to direct that episode of season 2. The creator of that show is a man named Christopher Storer. He directs most of The Bear, and he also is the director behind Rami's latest HBO special, More Feelings. That comes out this Saturday, March 23rd. By the time you're listening to this, it is out. If you haven't streamed it yet on Max, here's a clip from the trailer.
I'm done apologizing. I'm done saying that we're peaceful. For 20 years, we've had to prove to people that we're safe, right? Every time you turn on CNN, there's like some Arab dude talking about how Islam means peace. You know that guy? But he's always shouting it. He's always like, "We come in peace!" You're like, bro, that's the slogan for aliens. That's what aliens say before they take over the fucking planet, bro. I'm done. I'm done saying sorry.
That was from More Feelings, now available to stream on Max. As you can tell just by that snippet, Rami is venturing into some uncharted territory. It's a bit more pointed and political than maybe his earlier work, but it's no less funny because Rami has this way, and I think it is a singular thing that he is doing, which is he can create jokes around issues that are not typically conducive to comedy, whether it's the upcoming election, the crisis in Gaza, or what it's like to be a Muslim American in 2024, Rami somehow finds a way to get people to laugh about things they don't typically laugh about. And so before we return to this conversation with him from last year, I thought we'd give him a call to talk about this new special, all that's happened since we last spoke, and of course, the fact that he's about to host Saturday Night Live on the 30th this month, which is a sentence on a personal note I'm just so glad I get to say on this show. There are a few comedians that are pushing the medium forward in the way that he is. And so it means a whole lot that Rami was willing to talk this week in what is probably one of the busiest weeks of his life. And so with that, why don't we call him up? Hey, Rami.
Sam.
How are you doing?
I'm happy to hear your voice.
You came into the city to pick up a phone call for me. I really appreciate it.
For Sam, it's you gotta.
Last time we spoke on microphones, it was a week after you had finished observing Ramadan. You are now in the throes of it. I guess we're just going to keep talking on microphones once a year around this like very spiritual month of yours.
Yeah, talking with you has become part of my spiritual practice now, actually, you know, so next Ramadan, we got to do something, because now I'm actually in shock that it's been that long, because if you told me I'd ballpark, it's been 6 months. So that's really wild.
A little disturbing.
Yeah, I actually can't believe that that was basically a year ago. I think actually when I saw you, it must have been I was either on my way or I'd just come back from I was doing the Bear episode that I did, and then I was beginning to write something new, and we were about to go on strike. There was so much happening, and so now on the other end of that, now that that episode's come out, now that the film, that Poor Things came out, it's been really cool. You know, I kind of, everything feels a lot more out there, you know, in terms of connecting with people than at that time. I did a lot more stand-up since then, and I think I've just been spiritually reflecting on, you know, how do you find quiet when there's a lot of output happening? And I think that, you know, in the middle of a press thing and getting something out and doing shows and doing all that, the month is really needed, actually, for me. It's cool to slow down and be really deliberate and wake up at early hours in the morning and eat before the sun rises is actually, it's great. I don't look at my phone when I wake up that early because I know there's no one's calling, you know, at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. So it's a really great way to start the day in what are kind of crazy days. So you would think, oh, the days are so crazy, I'm getting less sleep. But actually, it's more energizing to start the way that I've been starting.
We're talking a couple hours before sunset. How are you at the end of days?
Oh, right now, you know, I feel good. Because now I think this is the ninth day of fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's really wild how the body just adjusts to whatever you tell it, right? So there are days when I feel like I actually can't make any sort of decision unless I have a burrito. You know, that day where you're just like, get me the burrito. I need the burrito, mm-hmm. You know, and I'll be there in 3 months. I'll be back in like burrito panic.
Is burrito panic the name of your next special?
It might be now. I think it's either that or if I ever, you know, reboot an improv group.
It actually is stronger as an improv group. That's a great title.
Hey, everyone, we're Burrito Panic. We'd love to take a suggestion.
First one, do you have another name for the group? You know, since we spoke, as you said, you've been touring a whole lot with this new special of yours. It's now out on Max. It's called More Feelings, which, by the way, could be the title of this podcast if you hadn't taken it.
I actually very much see that. Absolutely. Like, now that I know you a little more, I definitely see that.
I really love the special. I rewatched it last night. But for those who haven't seen it yet, you have this quote about stand-up that I just want to start with as a table setter. You said, stand-up for me is like I'm going to come on stage with something that I'm battling with, and I figured out a way to make it funny before I found the answer to what I'm looking for. So as you're on this tour, crafting the special, what were the ideas and the subjects that you were battling with?
I think there was this feeling of responsibility that I was trying to figure out. I've gotten the opportunity, you know, to make stuff, and I think every time I go to a show, especially now, this was really my first tour since we'd done the three seasons of Rami. For kind of a variety of reasons, I didn't really get to go out and do a lot of cities, some of them being COVID and other things. And so I was really feeling this different thing as a stand-up where you're getting to do small theaters and you're getting, you know, people are coming out in a way that they weren't coming out before. And you feel this thing of, oh, wow, you know, I have people's attention, you know, and what does that mean? And what is there to, what do you do with that? And I think that the special kind of tackles some of that in the sense of, you know, what does it mean to be public and how political are you supposed to be and how seriously or not seriously should you take that, right? Because I kind of always am, the comic in me is like, guys, don't listen to me. I did not finish college.
Right.
And I'm not, you know, I just don't. There's, you know, my scope is so limited and I'm just trying to take really big things and make them really dumb. And I was definitely dealing with that kind of responsibility, but then also thinking a bit about personal relationships, thinking about my family, thinking about getting married, you know, all of these themes, I think, kind of found their way into the special. And I think as I was touring, I was figuring out how much do I want to talk about each of them and what fits the moment of where I am. And so that in process quote you're talking about, I use it as like giving myself permission to be loose enough to be cool with how it goes. So to not walk in and kind of say, hey, you know, this is word perfect and I've tried this, you know, 120 times and you're getting that. No, it's there's a thing in capturing the medium of stand-up. It's never fully captured on film.
What do you mean by that?
There's nothing like a live show watching a comic do a joke for the first time and being there and seeing them. And as a comic, there's nothing like seeing the crowd and feeling it. And I think that what ends up as a special that you can view is a separate experience. It's like telling someone a story over, you know, but if you were, oh man, if you were there, you know. And so this gives you a peek at being there. It's truly never quite the same. And I think putting together the special while also experiencing the tour are kind of two different things. And then as the date kind of narrowed in, it became clear, okay, here are the things I want to talk about on this kind of February 3rd, or I think that was the date that we shot, like the 3rd and the 4th or the 2nd and the 3rd or whatever. Yeah.
As you were going on tour and then putting this special together, at the heart of it is this crisis in Gaza. And you managed to make jokes and create material out of a situation that I don't think anyone has been able to be funny about for the most part. And you are somehow holding both the ongoing tragedy of this moment while also making and doing bits around the edges. How the hell do you do that?
I think it's because it's not reactionary. So I think anyone who's kind of seen me do stand up over the last few years will, if you've seen me live, you'll see some of these bits. And it's really interesting because you'd be surprised how little of it is immediately topical. You know, there's obviously things that I'm talking about that you can tell I wrote in the last few months, but so many of the bedrocks of the personal stories, you know, I have this whole story about going on a date where talking about Palestine comes up, and that's a bit I've had, right? And so that's where it's kind of, you know, and when we talked last time, it's not like it was fully in the news cycle and it came up, right? Because it had come up in our season. So it's not sensational when it's something that you actually care about and has been kind of part of the conversation. And I also think that anyone who's coming to see me is also familiar with the idea that, yeah, this is something that means something to me. And so that being said, there's still a ton of reservation. And
what does that look like, the reservation?
I mean, it looks like just the questioning I think anyone could have with whatever they're doing. You know, like, does this help? I don't know, actually. And I don't, with my work, I am open to getting enough distance from it and then having kind of an honest assessment of what it did. Did this affect people positively? Did this affect me positively? And I think that I'll find different answers around different pieces. You know, I'm sure there's going to be jokes I regret, and I'm sure there's going to be jokes that I wasn't sure if I should tell, and then I'll look back and say, oh, thank God I said that. But it's really kind of complicated to think about it outside of the 60 minutes of the set, because it is everything outside of the set is, in terms of the real world, yeah, like you said, I mean, it's incredibly it's incredibly demoralizing and dark. And my hope is that this is something, but I don't know.
You know, recently we sat with Dr. Seema Jalani, who was working in Gaza and had come back. And there's a couple times in our conversation where we ended up making jokes after 20 minutes of just true pain and heartbreak.
Yeah.
And I like to think if she can make a joke, then I think, I mean, not only that she can, but she was like, all the doctors when we were over there, like, yeah, we would all try to do a joke sometimes because, oh my God, if we don't laugh, it's not possible for them to do their work.
And dude, that's my conversations have been that way with journalists who are there or with people I know who are there. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who, you know, knows a lot of journalists who've lost family members who've been through. And you know, he's like, yeah, last night we were hysterically laughing for an hour because it is actually a human response.
Yeah.
You know, it is something. And so I think it's about tapping into a feeling. And again, it's probably part of the name of the special and why I really lean towards calling it that, because it's kind of all that it is. But is there room for some sort of alternate response in this? And it is also a very Arab response. You know, it's a very, like, Muslims and Arabs are constantly joking about so many things. You know, like, I knew a guy who had lost a kid, you know, and you know, he's still like, it's the worst thing, and he's like, you know, he's like, yeah, I guess I have two more. You know, like he'll find a way to laugh in the middle of something that's absolutely terrible. It's an outlet. You know, I think, like, with tears there's also laughs. It's just how we respond.
Mm. One joke I don't think you'll regret is one in which you call President Biden, quote, having substitute teacher energy. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
And I just thought that was so nice of you to say that he has energy. I thought that was really kind that you said that about him. It was really nice.
Oh my God, dude.
I have a question for you. Don't worry. In 2020, the Biden administration called you and said, Rami, we've seen your work. We're huge fans. We subscribe on Hulu. We've totally seen all three seasons. I guess at that point, it was only one or two seasons. And they asked you to basically campaign for him in Michigan, which is a central battleground state for him. Obviously, you've probably seen in the news, Biden has clinched the nomination, basically, in delegate count. But in Michigan, there were over 100,000 votes cast as uncommitted ballots, which is a direct result of Biden's handling of the crisis in Gaza. So I have to ask you, one, has he seen the new special? Two, has he seen Poor Things? And three, have they called you yet?
Biden definitely loves Poor Things. The man's a freak. That we know. You know, in terms of the special, I'm not sure. In terms of will there be another call, probably not, especially if they've seen the special. But I do think that the uncommitted campaign is incredibly impressive because I think, you know, we're being really clear. I don't think that anyone I know is saying, okay, Trump is a better option. No one's saying that. But I also think that there has to be some sort of clarity around, we refuse to be silent. You know, we are a voting constituent. How are we not able to vocalize where we're at? And I think that's some of the pushback that I know the special will get, or that I know I've gotten from some people, where they go, aren't you afraid that Trump is going to be worse? And I kind of keep coming back to this point of, you know, that's abuse, right? It's like, you don't speak up because you don't want things to get worse, or you don't want to get hit harder, right? It's textbook, you know? And so we've created an abusive relationship between the voter and the ruling class, one where everyone forks up a lot of money that they could be putting into their family. It's hard to back anyone when you know there's never going to be campaign finance reform, right? So it's like, if you don't change the way money gets into politics, then the only thing that rules politics is money. And then it just becomes a corporate game. So all these guys are just, it's almost algebraic. It's interchangeable at a certain point. And I understand there's certain social civil liberties that we prefer from a Democratic presidential House, Senate, whatever, but it's starting to get thin, all of it. It's really all starting to get thin, especially because a lot of these laws, you know, don't change. And you see a guy, I'm almost more infuriated with Biden for continuing to fund the border wall. That's what really tells me, you know, you're using the social issues. You're saying you're for Muslims. You're saying you're for gay people and trans people. You're saying you're for women. But outside of those niceties, a lot of the ways that you're legislating, you know, other things are no different from the other side. And so don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's all the same. And I know that there's all the Supreme Court shit and all that kind of stuff. And so I always hesitate to get too deep on this stuff. I just think that what they did with Uncommitted was really important, because I think it's important to say, and I think having groups stand up, you know, we refuse to be used in name and not be recognized in how you govern. And I think that's very important.
By the way, I agree with you that the Uncommitted votes were meaningful, and I'm glad they did it.
Yeah.
I think on a very basic level, the fact that they could do it, that they're still able to do it, is something only one candidate is offering on the next go around.
Yeah.
That's not to absolve Biden or anything like that.
No, of course. We're looking at this like totalitarian alternative, right? Yeah. And so again, it's like, how do you voice where you're at and also understand that there's one version of it that can be healthy, constructive, going back and forth and figuring out how to get somewhere. And there's another version that might be really dark. And it's like, no, like, shut up. So that's interesting, right?
We should remind people that the special is really funny.
Listen, you asked me about Uncommitted. I mean, what can I say?
Let me set you up better. You mentioned at this point, it's almost become algebraic.
Yeah.
The math bit that you have in the special.
Yeah.
Whether it's that one or something else, what joke are you most proud of in this new special?
You know, there's this story, and I don't want to give away too much, but there's a story about this book report from when I was a kid that's in the special.
With Gandhi?
Yeah, with Gandhi. And I think it's probably one of my favorite things, because I actually, you know, my dad just saw the special, and basically it's a confession of something I'd been keeping from my dad my whole life. And I also think he kind of knew, but it's just funny the things that you kind of bring, you know, that you hold back from your family. And that's where the work becomes really fun, where whether it's making the show, doing the stand-up, I always kind of find the best conversations I'll end up having afterwards are with my family or with close friends. And it kind of opens up something new, you know.
What's your favorite bit that you cut out of the special that you can share here? Because it won't be on the special.
I have this bit that I think is going to exist in my next special. You know, I talk about prayer in the special, but I've been really into this idea of the way that one can, and I definitely do, I'll kind of judge what I'm praying for. And I wonder if I have room to pray for kind of all the things, like, 'cause there's all this heavy stuff going on, but then I'm also praying for really small things. And there was this bit that I did that got cut out of the special that was just kind of about praying for my friend's family in Gaza at the same time, but also praying for my friend's dog in New York at the same time. And the idea really makes me laugh.
That they're on the same pendulum?
Or like, how do you fit that all into one prayer, you know? Because sometimes you don't have a lot of time, but you want to pray for all of it. And there's just something really funny to me about that kind of just judgment on a space that should have no judgment is really funny to me. And obviously, I'm always kind of circling these spiritual things that kind of interest me and keep me up. But yeah, that was a fun bit that I think will be kind of a longer bit in the next hour that I'm working on.
Before we go, people are about to hear what is essentially your, I guess, life story. I don't know how to frame it. Yeah, I think we kind of went through your life story the best we could.
You were digging stuff up that I was so impressed. I was just, you definitely, even this quote you brought up in this part of this, I was like, man, where did Sam's just on it?
It's all love. And that's why, I mean, yeah. I love what you're doing. And I want to ask you this. You're hosting Saturday Night Live this coming weekend. And I was thinking about you starting as a stand-up, living at home in New Jersey, going into the city to perform. And then, of course, you know, when you were done performing, you'd get in your mom's car and you would drive back home through the Lincoln Tunnel, reflecting on the night you just had, the bits that landed, the bits that didn't. And I was just trying to hold that comic, that 20-year-old, with the one who was going to go into the city this weekend and host Saturday Night Live. Like the kid that was 10 years old watching George Carlin with his uncle, hosting the show that Carlin hosted. That, like, where are you at? Like, how are you doing?
The funny thing is, I think you just painted the picture for me. Like, I'm getting emotional hearing you say it because I don't think I've taken it in that way. You know, I think with stand-up and making, you know, making the show, and there's so many milestones that I've had where I kind of get to do them and look back and go, oh, wow. I think the thing about SNL is it's so legendary, right? I mean, whether I saw Carlin on there, the Will Ferrell years, everyone I really respected has either been part of that cast or has hosted that show. And it's a different one because, you know, so much of How We Made Rami or How I Do Specials is actually different than what television looked like 15 years ago. Some of it's the same, some of it's totally different. The media landscape is fragmented in a different way, all this stuff. But SNL is just SNL. And I think in this weird way, it's the thing I've allowed myself to be the most, holy shit, I get to go and do that. And I get to go to 30 Rock and sit in the writer's room and eat bad food with people at night. And, you know, it's a really late night endeavor. It's very Ramadan friendly. Just in terms of schedule, I mean, it's pretty fantastic. I started getting the schedule. I was like, these guys should just fast. I mean, they don't really start working until the sun is down. So it's fantastic.
They should have just hired you for the whole month.
Yeah, yeah. Just pop me in there. Dude, I'm ready. What else do you need? It's incredibly surreal. I when I think about the fear I used to have going to an open mic to, yeah, getting to, you know, I've been spending time past week prepping the monologue and I'll go up as I lead up to the hosting night and run it in clubs and get it ready. It'll also be really cool to go do it in a bunch of rooms that were some of my first rooms doing stand up, you know, around the city. And so I'm really excited about that. And I think that sharing it with a lot of my friends who I used to kind of force to come out to shows has been really fun. I mean, there's people I've gotten to hit up and be like, man, remember when I made you come to New York Comedy Club and we had no money and I made you pay $20 for the ticket and then you had to buy two things and you just looked at me like I'd ruined your month because I had, you know, I just drained your bank account.
Remember all the bad wings I forced you to buy because it needed to be a $30 minimum?
All the bad wings you ate for me? Dude, just traumatic stuff. I mean, because then it's like your buddy's out $50 and right. You're not even that good. You know, it's like, and then it's just the weight of that. And I almost wonder, like, what will be more pressure? Is it performing in front of people on a live broadcast, you know, national SNL? Or was it, man, my buddy's out $50 and this set better be good. And it might be the pressure from my friends. I honestly, all of that stuff is always harder to me than shooting an HBO special.
I love that.
You know, it's like, it's just the people who, when you've got a room full of people you know in debt because you're pursuing your dream, that's way harder than, you know, SNL. It's like, yeah, people, let me put it on. You know, like, if you don't like it, they'll switch the channel.
When you say to your friends, I'm indebted to you, you actually mean it.
I owe everyone hundreds of dollars for sure, at a minimum. And for some, it could be thousands. And I'm open to repaying that debt. Like, whoever wants to take me, you know, up for it. That's real.
This is great because this tape is going to come out before you host. So I hope people claim that $100.
If I brought you to a Bringer show and you're still suffering the consequences, call this number, the Talk Easy Podcast. You will be reimbursed.
Yeah, we're putting your cell, not mine, out there. oh, wait, before we go, when I was relaying that description of like a younger self, and you said you hadn't thought about it like that, what part of it made you emotional?
Thinking about the drive. Yeah, the drive. Yeah, the tunnel, the drive.
The tunnel.
Yeah, it puts it all into perspective. You know, it's like those quiet moments are the ones where you're kind of taking it all in. And I think that, yeah, so much of the self-reflecting was in that commute to Jersey. You kind of think about it, you go, okay, like, what worked tonight? What didn't work?
And will it ever work out?
And will it ever work? Yeah, I mean, there's always this ticking time, you know, feeling. And I guess that's just from being alive. You're just, one day you won't be. But quite directly to this kind of career, yeah, you really don't know. I think the next day, you know, I'll do Saturday and then I go have dinner with my parents on Sunday. So I'll get to do that drive. That'll be cool.
That's unbelievable. And when you do, I hope, and I mean this earnestly, I hope some part of you can enjoy it in the moment. I know it's impossible because you have a billion things to do and you have to put this special together, not to mention you have to go to the bank and withdraw hundreds of dollars to give to your friends the night of.
I think for a few friends, maybe we can call it like an even $850. I think I'll cut like $850 checks. I think 1,000 feels crazy. I'm going to say $850. Like, yeah, because I've bought a lot of dinners too. So I think I'm going to say $850 for everybody.
You're doing dinner math now.
I'm doing some dinner math just over the last 5 years when I've been able to cover dinner. So I'm going to say $850 for prior to 2018.
We're going to send it now to our conversation from last year. Do you want listeners to know anything before they hear this?
I just know that I was a different man. And I don't even know which man I was.
A better one or?
No, I'm part of what I'm doing is I'm shedding good and bad and better and worse, just different.
I can't even respond to that.
Yeah, don't. Cut it out. Keep it in. It'll all be okay.
Rami Youssef, as always, a pleasure. And good luck.
Thanks, man. This is the best.
Now, here is Rami Youssef and I talking in April of 2023. Hope you enjoy. Rami Youssef.
Yeah.
A pleasure to meet you.
So good to meet you.
How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm really happy to be here. A lot of stuff happened already off pod. There's a lot of good snacks outside and great coffee. Do you have any idea how many things I go to that are completely snackless? There's just not a single offering of anything. Maybe water, and you can tell it's tap. But here, I mean, this shit is filtered. Thank you.
Is this material for your new stand-up special?
I express myself in sometimes things that sound like they could be bits, but I'm not a tester. I don't test my material in conversation. If I think something's a bit, I keep it to myself. I'll try it on stage.
Because you don't want to give ideas away for free.
It feels cheap. It feels like I'm using a lunch to further my career when I'm just trying to have lunch with my friend.
Well, you're on a podcast, so if you want to try stuff out, you're more than welcome to.
This is a gray area, but I will say it falls a bit into the lunch category because of the snack quality that you offered.
Do Pop-Tarts constitute a lunch for you?
So there's this bag here of mini Pop-Tarts that is blowing my mind because I never want to commit to a whole Pop-Tart.
Of course.
And I feel bad that they figured out the product outside of my prime of eating it.
32 past Pop-Tart prime.
32 years old. It starts to get weird.
You know what's unbelievable? People always say about our show that we really talk about these big, weighty subjects, but really, we can talk Pop-Tarts.
Get me going on Gushers, and it'll get deep.
I am kind of afraid to get you going on Gushers. I feel like we'll never get anywhere. I do want to start with something that's just happened, though, because you released season 3 of this show, mm-hmm. Rami, and since the show came out, I believe in September of 2022, the tensions between Israel and Palestine, they have only escalated.
Mm.
Having filmed in Jerusalem, how are you thinking about both the conflict over there, but also the context that people now have in approaching something like episode 2 of season 3?
Yeah, well, you know, it was end of September. Was the third season of Rami. And then in August, we released the first season of Mo, where he's, you know, proudly an undocumented Palestinian guy in Texas. And then in Rami, we have a totally different take where Rami is, you know, American born. And the episode we did is almost completely around his own privilege as being kind of American born and going over. So what's been a culture shift when I think about when we started writing both those projects, it felt risky at the time to even, you know, and this was before there was like what I would call a big kind of viral Instagram moment that the summer of 2021 when people really started talking about what was happening with the occupation of Sheikh Jarrah and also even people really being open and saying, you know, this isn't a conflict, this is an occupation. You know, this is a completely inhumane thing that is happening. And I think even in the time, like you're pointing out, from writing the projects to releasing the projects, big change. Because by the time they came out, it was like, oh, wow, people are more open to having this conversation. It doesn't feel as whoa as when we wrote it, right? And that's in an American context, because I think in Europe and throughout other parts of the world, people understand what's happening in a more clear way. And so I think the approach that we've taken with both shows, to me, was always kind of a timeless approach because we're focusing on character. So we're not getting into the nitty-gritty of political debate as much as we are kind of saying, you know, what is the, you know, blind eye that an American Muslim like Rami turns to when, you know, he's living in a country that also has colonial tendencies, and then he's visiting a country that is being affected by colonialism. And so watching that all play out, again, from a personal place, right? Like, I'm not trying to use the show to sit and go back and forth. There's people who are way more qualified than me to talk about this, but we're trying to just put human characters in the middle of it.
Well, why don't we take a look at a scene from that episode where your character is in Jerusalem on a kind of Tinder-like date.
Yeah.
This is from season 3, episode 2 of Rami, now available on Hulu.
I can't believe you actually came.
Yeah, sorry, I was late. The fucking checkpoint took forever.
Yeah, with checkpoints, times are never accurate.
No, I know, it's so frustrating. Like, I'm from New Jersey. And we have, if you heard the Lincoln Tunnel, it's basically a fucking checkpoint. Like, it takes hours to get into New York, but sometimes it takes minutes, so everyone's always just confused. Like, and is it gonna take a long time? Is it not? And then it costs like $20 now to get in. At least you guys, you don't have to pay, right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. We don't need to keep talking about this.
I work in jewelry. It's why I came. What about you?
I work in a restaurant in Ramallah, but I'm starting my lingerie company.
Really?
Yeah, super affordable lingerie, and the tag is everyone has the right to be sexy.
Wow, your family's is okay with that? Like, religiously?
Muslims in the West are so fucking uptight. You act like no one ever kissed before. It's lingerie. Everyone wears it. Umma kaman tilbasam.
Yeah, of course. I'm not uptight. Like, I've kissed before.
My favorite part is him complaining about the commute, like it's going from Santa Monica to Los Feliz. It's like, it's east. I know, stuff happened.
Yeah, she's like, they built the wall that wasn't there before. And he's like, I get it, stuff happened. But, you know, you really could have told me before I got in.
Yeah,
you know,
you could have told me there was an accident on the 101.
So, you know, that's really where, you know, we talk about a character with privilege and a character who is clearly, you know, we get into his addict-like tendencies. And I think it says everything, too, though, about the perception, right? She starts talking about lingerie and he's like, what? You guys are that open about, you know, and not realizing that the American Muslim bubble is really that. It's a bubble and it's oddly disconnected at times from what's actually happening in the Middle East, because you have all these kids who are, you know, their parents were immigrants and haven't been back for a while. And they're really working hard to maintain the image they have of where they were. But it's from like the 80s. It's missing the last 40 years. And we grew up with it. And then you kind of go over and you realize, whoa, they're moving at a really different pace than what we've been trying to uphold.
There's not a whole lot in the middle of the Israel-Palestine Venn diagram. Did you create Rami in that scene so that they could both agree on something, which is that, you know, you're not a great guy?
The design of the episode from the writer's room was purely, Rami's going to sit with the Palestinian woman, he's going to sit with an Israeli woman, and in both situations, he's going to be like, what the fuck's going on with this guy? You know, that was 100% straight up character assassination on a level. It felt like the only way, again, to keep it, you know, to keep it character, but this woman that he goes on this field date with, I think the actress herself, I think, got the script and said, whoa, I could say this, you know, and that's what's fun about making something with a crew in the actual place. I mean, you know, here you're on set, only producers or writers talk. Over there, the guy, you know, who's doing craft service and bringing food will say, hey, man, you know, it would be better if you said in this part, and, you know, and he'll say that to me, you know, between takes, and I'll go, oh, okay, yeah, you live here. I'll take the note. You know, I'll take notes from anybody. You know, the transpo guy, whoever's got a thought. And same thing, you know, we obviously had a Palestinian director on the episode, but being with that crew, going through the script with them and really getting it to a place where they felt, okay, yeah, we're proud to shoot this, it was a really cool experience.
You recently said that this new season was mostly about a crisis of faith. What did you mean by that?
I think, you know, for the Rami character, we kind of built the show. The premise of the show was always, what does it look like for someone to not try to erase not just lineage, but their faith practice? Because I think what I was seeing a lot of was this attitude of, oh, I grew up religious, I grew up this way, but thank God now I'm free of that and I get to update. And I said, well, that's not really how I feel. You know, there's a lot of my tradition, a lot of my faith that I want to adhere to, but I'm kind of trying to figure out what it means to do that right now in this current moment in time. And I thought that tension was different. You know, the guy actually wants his faith. This season is the first time in the show where he's disillusioned by it. And we're kind of watching him, I think, arc from performing faith to kind of stripping it down and putting it back together again. You know, that's the journey that I wanted to put him through this season.
There's also in this season more of an emphasis on the crisis of faith in the American dream when it comes to your parents.
Yeah.
In particular. Was that on mind?
Very, very. I mean, I think it was also looking at, you know, we're coming out of COVID and we're coming out of a big reimagining and also a big dent to a lot of the systems that, you know, we've all been trying to invest in, you know, to work. And then we kind of watched a lot of them really shake. And that's still playing out now. You know, the rebounds of that are really happening today. And I think part of the pressure that a Rami type has or any kid of an immigrant has is knowing that their parents made a really tough move.
Mm.
That was a gamble. And, you know, you're the dice. And you got to roll the right way in order for them to feel good about what they did. And so when you spend a lot of your life feeling like I got to be the thing that makes my parents' existence worth it, it's a very odd pressure to have. But then, you know, really also wanting to step back from the parents who are like, whoa, was it really worth it for us to even come here and make this gamble too? You know, are we getting what we thought we would get? Is this the dream we signed up for? A lot of these things that they put a lot of stock in are falling apart for them. And I think that's also part of them realizing, oh, okay, you know, we've been living culturally in a certain way, but we need to be more spiritual because we're trying to invest in land. We're trying to invest in the idea of a country. We're trying to invest in this idea of a job and what a job means and to have a job that informs my identity.
Mm.
And then realizing, no, there's probably something more spiritual to really be digging into. And so, yeah, that awakening is happening for all the characters.
To understand the context of the dream, your parents had, I think we have to go back a little bit because you grew up in New Jersey with Egyptian parents, and you said as practicing Muslims, there was a performative element that felt like you were living in your own Truman Show. We've been talking a whole lot about performance. What did that look like?
I'm trying to remember the context in which I said that. That does sound like something I said. You're pulling great stuff.
I like that you like your words.
I'm like, dude, past me was...
Wow.
You ever worry that you're regressing?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Is that regress easy?
We do 52 a year, so I have a shot at redemption every week.
This one's a progress episode.
We're finding it.
I feel it.
Yeah.
Your progress is in how I answer these questions.
And your progress?
This podcast bears nothing on my progress.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've already had a good time like coming in.
Oh, okay.
This is in the win column. Yeah, I'm already having a good time.
Most of the do with the Pop-Tarts.
Then. The Pop-Tarts. I like the lighting in here.
It's nice.
You're nice. The AC is good. I'm good.
Yeah.
I won.
Sounds like Trump.
Honestly, if you didn't look at what he did and just, you know, some of what he said, an optimist.
I mean, I could see how someone who grew up with a photo of Donald Trump in their living room, as you did, would say something like that. You want to offer context for that for people?
My father, yeah, he worked at the Plaza Hotel for over 10 years. When he came to the country, he just started, you know, he was a busboy at the Waldorf Astoria. And it was because he spoke Arabic and there were a lot of high-spending Arab clientele that would come in from the Gulf.
He was previously a travel agent in Cairo.
Yeah. I forgot, you know my dad.
I mean, he was last week's guest, so.
But yeah, so he started busing and then he kind of went over to the Plaza and he was doing that too. And then eventually became a manager of all the food and beverage and all their like banquet halls and all that stuff. And so he'd do the Trump kids' birthdays or something. He's like, oh, I'm working late tonight. It's, you know, Eric's birthday, you know, like that, you know. And at the time wasn't bad or anything. It was just, this is just, you know, a guy my dad works with. But I think part of what we got to explore in the first season, which was something that was very true to my life, just that fear of being a kid and being so close. And at the time, my dad worked in the city when 9/11 happened. And I think part of what we got to do as a show and part of what even other things that I continue to explore is just the impact of that time for the psyche of a kid, especially a kid who felt implicated.
Is that how you felt?
Yeah, I did. Because you're looking at a screen on TV and you're seeing these people who've done horrible things. And, you know, one of them's Egyptian, the other one's this, the other one's that. And they have names that sound like people in my family. And some look like people that are in my family, you know, so, and that's the only reference point in any media was that, right? And then you start to have this self-doubt trickle in where I always felt like I had something to hide, even though there wasn't anything to hide. Mm. And then I also didn't get to fully digest my own background from, you know, like a pure context or even an inquisitive, curious context. It's all in the defensive, you know, so everything that I know is just about defending myself at that time. It's not a curious exploration and an understanding. And I see this in a lot of people of my generation where it's like now we're in our 30s and only just now we're really getting into our faith and our background from like a more curious place.
Specifically, do you remember a moment where you can kind of acutely remember playing defense as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is in the episode we made in the show of just like, I remember really being in a history class as a middle schooler and pointing to a map and really trying to put Egypt in Africa, you know, and just say wholeheartedly straight-faced saying I'm African, you know, like and then leaving and knowing I'm not really African. I know I'm not African, you know, and being in that place. But for me, the whole thing is I'm never going to be someone who sits and pretends like horrible things happened to me, you know, or we experienced hate crimes on a big level or something like that. And it's why in making the show, I never try to paint the family or the Rami character as victims, because I'm not in a position to say I'm a victim, but I am in a place to say, oh, you know, there are things that really happened here that, oh, maybe I can make an offering to unpack comedically, but it was a mind fuck the whole time. It took me a long time to even admit that.
So if it was difficult to explore or even examine parts of yourself at home, I wonder, when high school rolls around, you take this TV production class, was making videos in that class a way of examining and exploring parts of yourself that you previously weren't able to do?
You know, I felt this when I was a kid, even before I went to high school. The first thing I ever saved up for with my Eid, post-Ramadan Eid money, was a video camera. And I loved that. I remember being a kid and just going around the whole town and my street, and I would film things. And then we'd go visit my grandparents in Queens, and they had a computer that had a Windows Movie Maker. It'd be a whole day. We'd be there a whole weekend. And I would just be in there on that computer editing things that I shot. And then by the time I got to high school, there were more tools to do that. Then that became short films and that kind of thing. And then I started to write. I was writing those, and then I started to be in them. And so it was a big incubator. And my buddy, Jonathan Braylock, who I still work with a lot, but then my buddy, Steve Way, who's on our show, we did a lot together in that period. And I think we kind of started to find a lot of things that we were just making each other laugh. And then years later, we got to make the show together.
Well, we are going to watch one of those films that appeared on a YouTube comedy channel called Inside Joke Films. Now, for the context around this period, you're a freshman in college at Rutgers, 19 years old, working part-time at an Apple store in the meatpacking district.
Yes.
Attending acting classes at William Esper Studio. Once those classes ended, you would run to the train station, hop on, get home by 12:30, 1 o'clock, and fall asleep. That process was like wash, rinse, and repeat.
Yes.
And it's in that wash, rinse process that you wake up one morning, brush your teeth, and notice a minty saliva dribble running down your chin, which I think happened to me this morning, by the way. But what happened there?
I got Bell's palsy. The level of research is unbelievable. I'm starting to think you knew to bring these mini Pop-Tarts just based on something I had said at some point. Yeah, that was a big life changer for me because I was doing everything, you know, and I was going to college in the morning, then I'd go work at the Apple store, and then I'd go to acting class, and then I'd do an improv set at night or a sketch or whatever, and then I'd get home really late. I was truly burning myself out at a pretty young age. Then this thing stopped me and I said, okay, you know, I can't move my face. It's weird. Sometimes it goes away after a few days. They'll go, oh, it'll be a few days or it'll be a few weeks or it'll be a few months or it'll be a year. And if it's more than a year, it just might be how your face is, where half your face just doesn't work. You can't even blink. I had to wear an eye patch at night because my eye would otherwise dry out. And I had it for 6 months. This was like my biggest, at the time, bargain with God, which was, okay, if this gets better, I'm going to drop out of school. All I'm going to do is I'm going to work on acting. If it doesn't get better, I will accept it and I will continue school and I'll drop out of acting school and I'm just become a lawyer. You know, so I was really dramatic about it. And it made it a real inflection point for me to say, okay, if I heal from this, I'm actually going to free myself from trying to do everything and trying to please everybody. And I was in that place where I was enjoying performing, but I really wanted, you know, to do right by, again, you know, my parents made this gamble. I didn't know anyone who succeeded in comedy. You know, how do I go home and tell my dad, like, thank you for not seeing your parents for a majority of your life and I'm going to perform at a theater. But then this thing happened and I said, life's too short. I got to just do this for me. So it created that.
Well, why don't we take a look at you in that fork in the road moment where you turned Bell's Palsy into a short film aptly titled Bell's Palsy.
Hilarious.
Rami! We got it to Chicago Sketchfest!
Yes!
No! No!
What? What's wrong with your face?
John, I told you on the phone. I have Bell's Palsy.
We gotta come up with a plan.
No, there's no plan. We just need to... I got it!
This is great, man. You can't even tell. But, you know Halloween's over tonight, right?
It's okay, man. I've got a plan.
Really?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, Happy New Year!
Oh, come on!
What?
You still have Bell's Palsy?
John, I told you that the changing of the year wouldn't magically heal it.
That was my Christmas resolution.
That's sweet.
I know.
I have not watched that for 10 years.
How does that feel, watching that a decade later?
It's cool that we did it.
It's not that bad. I was like, this should be a lot worse.
Right? I watched one of the sketches we did. I was getting ready to be like, this is going to really suck. And then I went back and I was like, it doesn't really suck. I mean, yeah.
No, they're all tightly edited.
It actually means a lot because that's when you work with a network. They always edit you down, you know? But we had no network, man. We edited ourselves down.
I'm not here to cut you down.
I take pride in that. You know, I'm like, wow, we had that down. You know, maybe the writing wasn't always there. Maybe we were figuring out our voice, but we edited.
Your commitment to editing, to acting, to making these, it is what propelled you forward and brought you to Los Angeles. Did you make that call to come here at like 3 a.m. at a place called the Candlewick Diner? Because it seems like you love making big decisions in diners. And I love diners. I think you love them more than me and Michael Mann, who I thought loved them the most based on every film he's made.
I love diners. Sometimes I feel like my whole life's happened in a diner.
What happens to you in there? Is it just like the prices? Is it the good attitude?
In a Jersey diner, they are encouraging you to loiter. And I think that was really nice to have. I definitely edited some of those sketches. I would go plug in at a diner for sure.
Did you make your decision to come to LA at one of those?
It was kind of made for me because I booked this, you know, show on Nick at Night. And I actually was reminiscing about this the other day because it was funny. I got, you know, a call from my manager at the time and he said, listen, if you can fly yourself out to LA, they want you to do this producer session, right? For anyone who doesn't know, it's like you meet producers and then if producers like you, you test with the network. And if you test with the network, they pay for your flight. But the producer session, you don't get that. And so I remember looking at my bank account. I got this call. I was at Apple. I had just dropped out of school. I looked up ticket prices. I looked at how much money I had. I logged into my Wachovia bank app at the time. Then Wachovia famously got acquired by Wells Fargo. So this is just for anyone who's really into the economy.
That's most of our listeners.
I think a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
So Wachovia. So I go to my Wachovia, I type in my username, my password, I look at the amount of money.
Sounds like a virus.
It honestly really does have coronavirus.
Last night, man.
Yeah.
I picked up Wachovia.
I picked of course we are. She didn't tell me.
Oh, you're the editor? It's great.
This is staying in.
Well, you do like editing.
I love editing. And I'm telling you, the Wachovia bit has to stay in. I log into my Wachovia. I look at how much money I have. I look how much the plane ticket is. The disparity between what it will cost to get me there and what I have is...
Under $50?
It's under $300. It's okay. Tight. But at the time, $300, you're eating, for a couple of days. But at the time, I go, okay, I'm going to do this. My goal was not to get the show. It was to test. Because I thought if I could test for the network, at least I know they'll get me a hotel and they'll get me the flight back. I couldn't fathom that I'd actually book it because it just felt so insane. But yeah, so I end up going and I test and I was like, great. They got my flight back. They put me in a hotel. I literally go from my friend Lena's couch to getting a hotel over on Hollywood and Vine. I'm like, this is big. I'm by the Chinese Theater. I'm hanging out. I'm going to the Wax Museum. I'm living life. And then I booked the role and...
We're a couple blocks from there.
Dude, every time I drive by, and I lived here for 10 years, every time I drive by, I go, man, remember that trip? Because it's a big shift, It's across the country, which is almost like going to a different country. And I was living at home and then suddenly I'm living by myself. It's actually still the biggest thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life.
After the break, more from Rami Youssef.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
Hello, hello. Malcolm Gladwell here from Revisionist History, my podcast about the overlooked and the misunderstood. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Outliers. It was about exceptional people, the ones who operate at the outer edges of human performance. Outliers fascinate me. And last year, I discovered an outlier in the form of a community organization, Washington State's City of Bellevue. The city wanted to improve public safety by making their roads safer. So they created something that no one had ever built before, a platform that gave road users warnings of any dangers ahead in real time. How did they build it? By using a combination of technologies, the Cellular Vehicle-to-Everything Network, T-Mobile's 5G network, and 5G-connected cameras. People driving, bicycling, walking, running, can't forget people running, and people operating the transportation network now had a way to prevent crashes. It's been a huge success. The City of Bellevue earned first place in the community category at the T-Mobile for Business Unconventional Awards, an event that celebrates T-Mobile customers who've dared to innovate for the sake of meaningful change. If you're a T-Mobile for Business customer and your team has, like the City of Bellevue, innovated something really, really cool, I encourage you to enter. It's also a great way for outliers to be recognized in front of your industry's most influential leaders. You can enter at T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. That's T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
So you move here for this show called See Dad Run.
Yeah.
You're living in an apartment in Koreatown on 6th and St. Andrew Place.
Yes.
When you get this show...
Yeah.
I was thinking, because, like, you know, this writer's strike is upon us right now.
Yeah.
Will you be able to stay afloat through See Dad Run residuals?
That's the question. Whatever deal we made on that was part of an issue that the WGA had because it was like such a bad type of deal. It was a residualless deal, actually. And it's the kind of thing that they're trying to get to the bottom of. So I would say the lineage of See Dad Run is very directly tied to what the Guild is fighting for now, you know, over 10 years later. And so you could see that run to the current strike that is upon us. So that's a really clear line that not a lot of people are drawing. I think if you had a yarn board, it's a big one.
And yeah, it's like, it's kind of good that we're finally drawing it, that we're finally making the connection. That's always been there.
It's always been there. It's been unsaid. It's been awkward. It's been kind of one of those Hollywood things no one wants to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Should we?
And we've dared to.
Wow. You know, this is See Sam Run. You know, this is big. I stand by that joke.
And that's
keep it
show.
In the cut.
Really, that's
keep it.
It
in the cut. I stand by it. It is. It's not quite Wachovia level, but it's good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel sick after it. Unlike Wachovia. One of your co-stars on See Dad Run is an Oakland comedian named Mark Curry.
Yes.
He decides to take you on the road where you open for him. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, there's one night in particular. You're at a hotel and you're by yourself in your room. And it sounds like, I think because you just bombed, that you kind of lean into and start to discover your comedic voice as a stand-up. Is that right?
I bombed so bad that the Miami Improv booked another comedian for the next night because I did so poorly the night before. You know, I was supposed to do 15 minutes and then I did it. But then the next night they said, hey, you only need to do 5 tonight. You know, we got someone else to do. In between the nights, I had this thing. I didn't know anyone in the city. I was so embarrassed. I was so ashamed. And then I go into the hotel and I completely just force myself to say, okay, I don't want to feel that again. And I wrote a lot that night. And then the next night I came in, and even though they had cut my time, like my 5 was really on it. But I remember the club owner really being like, where was that last night? And I just said jet lag. And then I walked away kind of confidently.
It sounds like you made a kind of pivot in the work. What do you think you were moving towards?
It was just digging deeper. It was playing a different kind of room. You know, I started doing stand-up when I moved to LA. You know, I'm doing like Silver Lake Rooms, Burbank, these kind of different kind of demographics, as opposed to when you go to a Mark Curry show and it's like, I could feel this thing of what's your essence, as opposed to some of these smaller rooms I was starting to do stand-up in. It was just, do you have a witty idea? These rooms, they were like, dude, are you funny or are you not funny? Because if you're not funny, we'll just talk until Mark comes out. It wouldn't even be like I bombed and it was silent. They would just watch me for 2 minutes and then go, anyway, so, and then just conversations start. Full conversations are happening while you're doing stand-up. And so immediately I had to put myself in a position of how do you hold attention, and also realizing the value of having people's attention. Don't waste it. Really offer them something. So I just dug much deeper and I had to move through a lot of fear. And it was really nice to not be in a city where I knew anyone. Those early road dates were just really good for that. You know, you don't know anyone. So just go to the hotel room and write and get better.
But it essentially all came back to essence.
Yeah. Any useful diversion from someone's attention to say, watch this, listen to this, do whatever, I take very seriously. And I say, well, I better be providing a unique essence of something for them if I'm gonna ask them to take an hour to watch my special, 30 minutes to watch an episode. Like, why? Why am I asking you to not
talk to your family for 30 minutes. This better be worth it.
Well, then I think we should probably take a look at what may be the earliest televised example of you stepping into and finding your essence, which comes in 2017 when you made your late night debut on The Colbert Show.
Yeah.
The performance did come on the heels of Trump's Muslim ban.
I still think we're going to be okay. I really do. Because I believe in God. Like God. Not yoga. But. And I know that's a weird thing to say. I get it. You know, religious culture can be crazy. I don't agree with all of it. I grew up in a town where I watched my gay friends struggle to come out to the religious community. And now I live in LA, where I'm a religious person struggling to come out to the gay community and tell them what I think. And they're just like, you believe in God? Dude, that's so gay. I just, for me, God is hope that there's more to life than what's in front of us. You know, that even if things seem impossible, there's still a chance that it could be okay. And I'm not trying to be preachy. I'm really not. Like, all I'm trying to say is just submit to Islam because it's the truth. And that's the only way you'll be saved. Seriously, that's the only way.
That was 6 years ago now.
I feel like I'm so much younger there.
26?
Yeah. I still can't believe that they let me say that on TV, too, because that was one where the producers were like, I remember just getting this call because they saw the transcript of the set, and they're like, so, yeah, so you're trying to say, you're trying to end the clip with submit to Islam. and I remember I had to, like, bring them out to a show to say, no, it's a bit. It ties to, you know, what's happening, and it's one of my favorite kind of bits because it's the kind of bit where if you are kind of just an open-minded, I'll say, comedy fan that skews liberal on a certain level, you watch that and you go, oh, that's really funny. Like, he's playing on this fear that everyone has. If you're conservative, you're like, oh my God, look at this. It's the Muslim agenda. And if you're Muslim, you're like, nice. It's the Muslim agenda. You know, so it kind of hits all three buckets, which is what I, you know, is kind of my favorite, you know, lane to be in.
You're always thinking about those three buckets?
Yeah. I want them all to be happy, which sounds like an insane way to live.
It does.
Sometimes I feel, you know.
Insane.
Insane. And I know you feel it too.
Don't drag me into this.
Of yourself. Dude, come on. You do.
Well, you had me at Wachovia.
This is such a good bit. That bit comes from pain and shame.
Yeah.
You know.
I like that you know. That's good.
I know, dude.
You can hear it in my voice.
Yes, man. Stuff people can't even see on the podcast. It's a body language thing. Oh, wow. Seeing that's crazy. I haven't watched that.
And looking back at that clip, it feels like a clear bridge between your early comedy and the comedy that would inform the pilot of Rami.
Yeah, I did that Nick show, and then I was doing The Road with Mark, and I remember that show ending and thinking, okay, cool, I was on a show, and now that I've been on a show, I'm going to be on other shows, I'm going to act. And it never happened. I was so bad at auditioning, or I would get really anxious, but then I would also feel like nothing quite fit me. You know, I would go in, and they'd be like, you're not the leading guy. You're not exactly the nerd. Well, we want you to play the brown guy, but they didn't understand the reference in which they were writing it. They would write something that was for someone who was Indian or Pakistani, and then they'd say, oh, you're kind of, you know, there was no real. So there was this thing where the acting thing just wasn't hitting. And I almost forgot for a period that I knew how to make my own things because I just got so into the acting world. And then I said, hold up, I got, you know, this gift of an acting job, but that's over. And now I got to go back to digging into what it is I really want to say and what I want to do. And so there was this period of just doing stand-up for the first time in a serious way. It was like 3 years straight where it's just I'm doing stand-up every night. I'm figuring out what the next chapter of my life is going to be. My first ever open mic in LA was with my buddy Ari Kacher. He'd been working on Gerard Carmichael's show, and I had been opening for Gerard. I'd also been opening for Mo, who, you know, we made, you know, his show together now. And so in that time, I was just doing a bunch of sets with them. But then Ari and I kind of started talking about, okay, cool, like, let's do the show. It was a really productive time.
From there, you make the show. It premieres in 2019. You win a Golden Globe in 2020. But throughout the show's run, it's been 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot of people have compared Rami to programs like Louie, Master of None, Fleabag. But I want to talk about the influence of Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Because you said once, there's a twinship between Jewish humor and Muslim humor. What is that?
It's like an inherent sarcasm, an inherent self-deprecation. You know, it really hit me just how not celebrating Christmas really put me so closely intertwined with my Jewish friends. It's you're really missing out on this massive human event. You feel like a 5-year-old adult because everyone believes in magic and you're like, dude, this is just a ploy for Macy's to sell stuff in December. You know, and you're looking at your Jewish friends and they're the only other ones who know. And so there's something about that in America where I feel, oh man, we're the only ones who really get each other here because we missed out this childhood window of daydreaming about Santa. We're like, yeah, that dude wouldn't fit down the chimney. And you got a bunch of kids who are like, of course he fits because of the, you know what? And you're just like, you guys are brainwashed. It creates something very early on that I've found to be at the heart of our humor. You know, I mean, yeah, look, Larry's just, I think, the funniest. And he's so honest to what he thinks and his perspective. And it's why I always think Muslims and Arabs are some of the funniest people because they're so steadfast, whether in what they believe or what they think, they're not going to move off it. Mm. And that's comedy to me. And when you have 4 people in a room who all think that way, it's just so much certainty. It's just hilarious. It's just so funny. I feel that's what's really funny about Larry. He's so certain, despite being completely wrong.
That, and so to me, is Rami in a whole lot of situations. Like thinking back to that scene we started with at the beginning of this conversation. You're on a Tinder-like date, but he's certain that he's the best she can do under these
under conditions. Under the occupation.
Yeah.
That is definitely something that is his own kind of probably Larry David-ish moment.
It is reminiscent of Curb Your Enthusiasm because there are so many moments in that show, like in Rami, where you're sitting there going, oh my God.
Dude, what are you?
Will he just stop talking? Okay, but hold on. We're talking about the comedy side of this show.
Yeah.
But so much of the writing and the dialogue around Rami is about representation, what this show means in this moment and what it tells us about X people, mm-hmm. which I've always found to be sort of reductive and not terribly interesting.
Yeah.
So I want to ask about something more specific, which is this quote you have. You said, my work is not about showing that we're all the same. It's actually about highlighting the differences because we're not all the same, but we're all trying in a similar way and we're all feeling in a similar way regardless of those differences.
Yeah, I stand by it even more so because I think the level of specificity that we aim for is not with the intention of creating a flag to represent. It's just the thing that me and the people who make the show want to do with this specific set of characters. And it's not really meant to be wholly representative of almost anyone, even if you get really subsecty, you know what I mean? I've always felt like the show has a right to exist outside of that framing because then it allows it to be something that is an exploration in its own tone and its own thing and not have to fit into, hey, Muslims, we've got a show for you, because that puts us in an impossible position that is also an inaccurate one. And so, yeah, I'm not interested in saying we're all the same. Like, I'm more in favor of saying, no, no, we're different, but we have the same debts. We have the same stresses. We have the same desires, even though the way we approach them or the tools we have or the belief systems we have look different, you know? And so it's like, yes, on a level here, I'm saying something has been done to say that people who live in the Middle East are not human, you know? So on a level, that has been done through a lot of the media that's happened over the last 30 years. There's been a dehumanization. So in terms of where Rami falls into the realm of representation, it probably mainly checks the box of, if you thought we weren't human beings, we are. But if I'm trying to tell you anything other than that, it's going to fall short. I'm not trying to say this is what Muslims are like all over. I'm not trying to say that I'm just like you. I'm not trying to say whatever, but I'm trying to say the process of surviving and the process of living and being, all of that is really similar. And so the monoculture of just us, we're all the same, it's well-intentioned, but it really falls short. And then sometimes the goal of what that does, that's where I see the effects of colonialism still happening. And, you know, there's countries in the Middle East where, you know, you'll go into a restaurant and they only have a menu in English. If you don't read English, don't even be here. These are the kinds of things we've been kind of led to believe in our own culture because the storytelling and the narrative of what American culture is so strong. And I'm not saying it's all bad. I mean, I love that I grew up here. And part of loving growing up here is getting to talk about all the baggage that comes with that and how that influences everyone everywhere. And what's fun about making these shows and, you know, now we're, you know, we're making more shows and we're doing other things that I've been able to do with my production company as it's grown out of making Rami and making other things is like, we just get to show so many different slices of that. And I think representation is not one show. It's like 30, you know, it's movies. It's a lot of artists getting to try and getting to fail and getting to mess up and getting to be imperfect and getting to succeed. That is more so what I think that means as opposed to, you know, anything one season of television or even three could do.
That basically squares away the macro conversation. As we leave, I want to bring it back to you as a person.
Mm.
Because again, that episode that we've been interrogating and circling over and over again, episode two, what happens in the last 10, 15 minutes involves you trying to get past the border, having your coat stolen. Inside the coat was your passport. These preteens took it in part because you stole their bike. And you have this quote. You said, "I think what happens with this kid, the kid who stole your coat, boomerangs for Rami and becomes this ever-present haunting of what happened and is, for me, very symbolic of the manifestation of guilt that I just feel as a person all the time." I guess I want to sit with that because at 32,
yeah,
having just finished Ramadan and where you've been thinking about where you stand and where you are and where you want to go, that guilt that you feel, are you still working through that? Is that still fueling a lot of the work and who you are in this moment?
Yeah, it's just, I think about the cost of living all the time. Just what it costs for us to have everything we want all the time, right? There are people in the margins of this country that are, you know, deeply suffering in ways that people in other parts of the world aren't. Then we've, you know, lived between New York and LA where you can walk into a supermarket and get whatever you want all the time. You walk into a clothing store and get whatever you want all the time. I'm willing to bet a lot of the people who listen to Talk Easy are able to afford some of those things. And that comes at a cost that's way beyond that. You know, when I look at the way the episode ends, haunts him the whole season because this character for sure is talking about his American passport and he's being very ignorant in how he's doing it. And then in order to fight for his privilege, someone in that episode directly suffers and they continue to. And he kind of goes off and he's trying to live his own life and he's spiraling in this way and then realizing, oh man, you know, and then it kind of comes to a moment at the end of the season where he tries to do something towards that debt, even if it's, you know, successful or not, isn't even the point, is he addresses it. And, you know, I think there were a lot of people who saw only that episode and didn't finish the season and were really upset by it. You know, they're really upset by what happened. I think part of that too, even going back to the representation conversation, when there's so little that even touches something like Palestine, I understand those sensitivities. And, you know, it's our stab, it's our try, and it's something that we made with like a Palestinian crew and Palestinian director who really, they understood the vision for the whole season because we're asking people to watch 10 episodes, not just the first two. We're asking people to be invested in what this means for a character. And so what it was trying to get at for me is that feeling of sometimes merely the way that you're living has a cost that you never have to look at. And if that is inspiring for me to like figure out anything I could do in my own, at times very minimal position in the scheme of the world, or if at any times I have windows or shots to talk about things in a bigger way, then I can't feel good about that because I need to continue to try and be at least somewhat part of making that a little bit better. And it's funny, you guys say it out loud and yeah, it sounds crazy, or it sounds just incredibly, I don't know what it sounds like, but
it sounds like you listen to what your uncle told you as a kid. He said, it's the human's job to give back more than what they take.
That's one of his good quotes. That's a great quote. I think about that a lot.
It's funny. We keep circling around this idea of what it means to have a voice in this moment while not being overly delusional about its power. But I do want to know if you think your work in some ways is in line with the generations that came before you, because it seems to me that it feels like an amalgamation of the work your family has done, which includes your grandfather, who was an interpreter for the Arab League and the United Nations, then your father, as we mentioned, last week's guest, the travel agent in Cairo who would show Americans the pyramids. And so in thinking about being an actor, a writer, a director, the creator of this production company, Cairo Cowboy, do you feel like your work is a kind of amalgamation of both interpreter and travel guide?
Wow, that's beautiful.
The funniest answer would just be like, no.
You know, it's a soft no, but no, it's beautiful to hear it in that context. I think for me, I really respect people's time. You know, you only have a half an hour to watch them. You know, you have such a busy life. When you watch anything that I say, I'm not in a position to give you hard facts about anything. It's just comedy, you know? But what I hope I'm able to do is just bring people closer to some of their own human questions. So a lot of what I'm doing and anything I'm doing is openly offering and workshopping the stuff that is going on in my head or in my heart or that I wonder about. I'm open to do that in as naked of a way as I know how to. And the hope is maybe that inspires a conversation you weren't going to have with someone in your family. And I think especially growing up in a few different communities, not even just, you know, the Arab or Muslim community, but a few different communities where it was hard to talk about certain vulnerable things. My hope is that, you know, me asking my questions, me doing my workshopping, me finding the funny patterns, and me also failing sometimes in how I do that, and other times succeeding in how I do that, is an offering that helps digest some things that are not digestible. Then I feel in my own little corner of what we're all kind of chipping in to try to do, I'm doing something, you know?
Well, then my last question here, if we ever like listen back to this or do this again.
Oh, I'll be back.
Okay. So when we do this again.
Yes.
Let's have this as a time capsule for us. At 32, recently married.
Yes.
What are those questions that you're asking yourself in this moment? We don't have to have the answers for them. What are those that you want to put on record?
Yeah, you know, that I want to put on record is just, we're really siloed right now. I think a lot of people are really siloed into their experience, into their phone, into the thing they're doing. What I've been thinking a lot about is, what is community going to look like? And how do we bring back being connected in as many real life ways as possible? And a lot of what I've been thinking about right now is, how do these stupid jokes and how do these shows, you know, where we're just giving, again, workshopping, giving our best stab and like trying to get at that, you know, ethereal it. What does that turn into just in terms of people getting to feel less lonely? But a lot of what I've been thinking about is just, yeah, well, what does that actually mean off screen? What does that actually mean beyond asking for people's attention? What happens once you have it? And where does that go? I don't think I'm the person to lead anyone once I have their attention, but it's more like, yeah, what does it look like to just turn that into a way where people just get to genuinely feel closer together in real life? And I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about, I'm sure you've been talking about in your circles a lot about AI and how what we're going to see over the next few years is just going to be so rapid. And I think that need for real life togetherness is going to be at an all-time high. Mm. And so I've just been trying to figure out, you know, what do I need on a personal level? But that's a big question.
You still want to make the show?
There's a lot I want to make. when we finished the first season, I realized what it took to make a season of television. And I remember thinking, I would love to do this for 3 or 4 seasons and then put it down for a bit and live some life. There's nothing about the story that says you can't take off for a while and then come back and say, you know, here's where this is at. So I think a lot of the decisions I'm making right now is, yeah, when does that hiatus come? Is it now or are we going to do one more? It's probably now.
Well, look, whenever you put it down, I'll make a promise that I'll still be here on the other side of it, if it's any consolation. And in terms of stupid jokes, boy, we have made so many of them. I don't know if they've helped make meaning out of this conversation. I hope.
But I think in the time here, we've definitely caught Wachovia.
God.
I think it's a great ending.
Rami Youssef, a pleasure.
So fun.
Buddy, that was great.
Wow.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
Hello, hello. This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. Let me tell you an unconventional story about a healthcare group that wanted to improve their efficiency. Boston Children's Hospital. They were already a leading pediatric facility. Their patient outcomes, workflows, and delivery of care were already great. But they wondered, how can we make it better? So the hospital got to work. Their idea was to build what they called clinical mobility, meaning a system which would allow their staff to access information and interact with patients on mobile devices anywhere in the hospital. And what made that possible? 5G. The hospital rebuilt their entire system with 5G technology at its core. That infrastructure now supports thousands of phones and tablets so practitioners can communicate with patients on a whole new level. Boston Children's also made sure the system could flex and scale to handle medical advancements like robotic surgery and virtual reality for training and research. This was worlds away from how they had previously operated. This innovative work hasn't gone unnoticed, first by patients, but also by their peers. Boston Children's was a first place winner in the industry category at last year's Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business, an event that celebrates customers who've dared to innovate for the sake of innovation. If the Boston Children's story rings a bell with you, if your team has asked the same questions about building a better business solution, I encourage you to enter this year's awards. It's a great way to be recognized for smart, disruptive thinking in front of some of your industry's most influential leaders. You can enter at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. That's tmobile.com/unconventional awards. I'll save you a seat.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. If you want to go above and beyond, sharing the program on social media, tagging us at TalkEasyPod, really all of this helps new listeners find the show. I want to give a special thanks this week to the teams at Narrative PR and HBO. I also want to thank Eric Sandler, Owen Miller, and Sarah Brugger at Pushkin, Lily Salzberg, and of course, our guest, Rami Youssef. His new special, More Feelings, is now available on HBO or Max. You can also see Rami host SNL this Saturday, March 30th. For more episodes, I'd recommend listening to our talks with Bill Hader, Quinta Brunson, Natasha Lyonne, and Dan Levy. I think all of them have hosted SNL. If they haven't, they should. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. We make mugs that come in cream or navy. We've also made a record with Fran Lebowitz, a sentence I never thought I'd get to say. To get that and more, visit our website at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. That's TalkEasyPod.com/shop. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden. I want to say a special thanks and goodbye to Caitlin. She has been with us for a few years now, and she is going on to continue making her show. It is called Slut. If you have not listened to that, you really ought to. You can find that wherever you are listening to this. Talk Easy would not be what it is today without Caitlin and all that she has done. We are going to miss her a whole lot here, but I'm so excited to see what she makes next. With that, our episode was mixed by Andrew Vastola. It was taped at Spotify Studios in Los Angeles and Pushkin Industries in New York. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Chris Shenoy. Graphics are by Ethan Seneca. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin. They include Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Starnes, Kerry Brody, Kira Posey, Jordan McMillan, Tara Machado, Justine Lang, Sarah Nix, Malcolm Gladwell, Greta Cohen, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with another episode. Until then, stay safe and so long.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry. And me, I'll be there too. Enter now at T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.